Hello and welcome to Animal Voices, listening to CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm your host, Lauren Corman, here with Rob Moore, co-hosting and doing the news today, and Lamia teching for us, as always. And we just breezed in on our bikes and trying to gather our thoughts as we prepare for the show. It's going to be a busy one. We're going to kick things off with an interview done recently by Mira Saleh-Ross, who used to co-host. I guess she was officially the host for a while, but she was the co-host before. And in this upcoming interview, this pre-recorded interview, we're going to hear from John Curtin, and he is a British animal liberation activist. And this interview was done as part of a video project about animal rights and globalization. It's a project that Mira Saleh is working on with her partner, Mark. And John Curtin has been fighting for animal liberation since the early 80s. And you could say, this is according to Mark, you could say he's the type of activist who's seen and done it all, from illegal activities to school talks. John's passion and compassion for the animals is sincere, and his dedication is something someone can look up to. Also, in case it's not clear, at some point John discusses in the interview about a direct action that he did and its coverage in Bite Back, and he responds to some of the editorial choices that Bite Back made, and he talks about his representation within the media as well. So we're going to hear that, but before we do that, we're going to hear a little bit of news with Rob Moore, and then we're going to come back with a couple other interviews. So I'll let you do the news, and then we'll talk about the second half of the program.
Sure. Well, I just have the one story today, but it's a long one. I'm going to read the whole thing because I think it's just important. It's from the Times-Dispatch out of Virginia. The hog truck toppled into a ditch and overturned last Monday morning on a winding stretch of U.S. 258 about 2 miles south of town, spilling its cargo of 180 hogs into people's front yards. The confused animals rooted in the grass or scrambled into nearby woods. Some of them lay squealing in the wreck. One hog set off down the narrow two-lane blacktop where morning commuter traffic came to a halt. About 30 hogs lay down for a nap in the sunshine between two houses. Police radios broadcast the bad news. It was time for another emergency hog roundup, an unusual slice of life in the neighborhood of Smithfield Foods Incorporated, the world's largest pork producer. Every day, dozens of trucks packed with 150 or more hogs converge on Smithfield's two large slaughterhouses from hog farms in Southside, Virginia and North Carolina. And every year, a few of those trucks plunge off the rural highways near the plants. I hate to admit it, but it happens all the time, said Jerry Hotstetter, a spokesman for the pork processing giant. Senior Trooper Beverly Macy estimated that between 2 and 5 hog trucks overturn every year in southeastern Virginia, most often because the drivers are traveling too fast for rural roads. The number of hog truck accidents is not inordinately high, Macy said, considering the sheer number of hog trucks converging on the Smithfield plants. What is unusual is the results of those accidents. Roadside roundups of scores of 220-pound hogs in the midst of accident scenes. I think we could write a book about rounding up hogs, said I.N. Buddy Jones, longtime chief of the Smithfield Volunteer Fire Department. He estimated he has responded to more than 100 emergency hog roundups during his 37 years with the department. The roundups used to be a real challenge, Jones said, because most of Smithfield's hogs were raised on private farms where they had some degree of freedom. When a truck crashed and broke open, they'd take off on you, Jones said. He has chased them down highways, through woods, and into pastures full of cows. Some eluded their pursuers for a day or two. But now, Smithfield's hogs are raised in large corporate farms where they have little freedom of movement. They seem bewildered when Rex casts them out of captivity, Jones said. They stick together and seldom travel more than a couple hundred yards, he said. They are more likely to present problems by lying down in an inopportune spot, such as a highway, than by leading a chase. Which is kind of the saddest thing of all, like they don't know what to do with freedom when they have it.
Mm.
As Smithfield's production has grown, the company has established a rapid response team to recapture hogs. In effect, a hog truck crash SWAT team, authorities said. Last week, a homeowner tried to use a hose to drive hogs off his yard. The hogs happily settled into the resulting mud. From a distance, hog truck accidents tend to inspire jokes and lighthearted news headlines, but up close they are grim affairs. dozens of panicked swine stumbling about, some of them with injuries so severe the animals are shot on the spot. The Norfolk-based animal rights organization, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, sometimes sends representatives to the scenes of hog truck accidents to argue that injured animals be quickly euthanized rather than loaded onto new trucks. PETA has tried to persuade the State Department of Agriculture to send veterinarians to hog truck accident scenes to decide which animals should be shot. I have a lot to say about that, but I won't. Ray Mays, chief of the Isle of Wight County Animal Control Office, said he never would forget a crash a few years ago when an overturned hog truck caught fire, burning many of the hogs inside. He had to shoot more than 20 suffering hogs in the head that day to put them out of their misery. Mays, who will retire this year, said he told his wife 2 weeks ago, "I hope I can get retired before another hog truck turns over." But it was not to be. After the accident on Monday, US 258 was partially closed for nearly 5 hours. The driver, who suffered minor injuries, was cited for driving too fast. Of the 180 hogs in the truck, 23 were either killed in the wreck or had to be shot. The survivors were taken on to the slaughterhouse. And that's the story I wanted to read this week because, of course, it highlights the transportation issue of cows and pigs and chickens and even like the free-range animals who are supposedly free-range and treated humanely or less cruelly, if that can be used as a term, still go through the same transportation process as those in large factory farms. And it's something people need to be educated about.
Yeah, there's just so many different parts of the commodity chain that we're often not talking about.
Yeah.
I think that on this program especially, we really concentrate on sort of the what the industry would call the growing aspect, you know. So what is it like for animals to in factory farms, but not necessarily about the transportation issues. I guess we do talk about the slaughter issue, but there's this gap in between. So
yeah,
there's just so many opportunities for animals to be treated terribly. And, you know, in addition to these trucks spilling over and that type of thing and all the horrible cruelty that comes from that, there's also just issues with, you know, the animals not being fed or not being given water or being transported in very cold temperatures, you know, pigs freezing to the side of the trucks and things like that. There's all these other kind of issues as well, in addition to these sort of what would get seen as random accidents.
Mm-hmm. And for days at a time on the road,
yeah.
For 2 to 3 days, they're stuck in a truck. Without food and water or any rest.
Yeah.
For days.
Well, if you're just tuning in now.
Not to start the show off on such a sad note.
No, but it's good. I think that the following interviews will hopefully continue to inspire people. I called this show an activist sampler because we're going to be hearing from Mira Saleh Ross, and she did an interview with John Curtin, who is a British animal liberationist. He used to be a member of the ALF, and now he's a school educator, just general public educator. And we're going to hear that interview right away, and then we're going to come back and hear from Melissa Tkachuk and Josh Matlow, and they're going to tell us about the new animal dissection policy they're trying to encourage Toronto teachers and the school board to adopt. And then we're going to hear from Paul Watson, the captain of the Farley Mowat, and he's very heavily involved with the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society, and we're going to talk about some of the tactics they've been using, very controversial, out on the ice this year to raise awareness about the seal hunt. So take it away, Lamia.
Hello. Okay, so we're thinking we're going to start with something boring. I'm sure you've told that to people a million times, but can you tell us who you are, where you live, and give us an overview of your direct action activism?
Well, the first two bits are easy. My name's John Curtin. I live in Coventry. And as to give you a rundown of my animal rights activity, that's difficult. I've been involved for 20 years, so therefore I've been involved in a hell of a lot of different types of campaigning, right from illegal direct action and breaking to laboratories and damaging property, right through to, you know, giving school talks and animal rescue and some undercover things sometimes. So lots and lots.
Was it for you an evolution? There's some people who say, you know, they participated for many, many years in letter writing campaigns. things, in you know, in protests. They held booths at conferences and things like that before they got tired and frustrated and decided to get involved with more direct action and even feel like liberating animals was something important. They felt they were accomplishing something that was really practical as opposed to something so abstract as writing this. So was there this kind of evolution for you, or you just jumped right into direct action?
Yeah, I mean, everyone's got their different story, and that's the good thing about it. Everyone's got the different story of how they got involved and what it was they got involved and the speed of their involvement through to direct action. I must say, mine was very quick. But, no, it wasn't really, because I think my introduction to animals starts off when I was 16 and I went out with a woman who was vegetarian. Yeah?
It happens often. It happens often that way with guys who meet a woman who's vegetarian, so I think that's a good influence.
It was, you know, but, you know, so I go out with this woman, and then 3 days later, you know, I'm still eating my burgers and my sausages, and my idea of going for a romantic date was to go to the burger bar, and she'd have her tomato soup, and I'd have my burger. Yeah, she wasn't an animal rights sort of vegetarian, she was just one from, she just had a natural revulsion for me.
Uh-huh.
And then 3.5 months later, I'm still doing it, you know. 3.5 years later, I'm still doing it. And for me, you know, it was like, it had nothing to do with me, this vegetarian thing, you know. I was glad that she was vegetarian, but it was an alien thing to me, you know. Mm-hmm. But then I had the dog die in my arms. I went to live in Ireland, and I had the dog die in my arms. And that was, for me, it was literally a road to Damascus jobby for me, where I then understood, my God, you know, animals do matter. They do feel pain. They, you know, all this stuff about that human beings are the master race of the universe. I just discovered there and then it was nonsense. You know, we're all in this together. We all suffer. And then through frustration with myself, really, I felt guilty about how long it had taken me to understand this, you know. So as soon as I got, then I consciously wanted to get involved with helping animals. And the Animal Liberation Movement, I was very lucky, that was in 1983. And the movement was in its, very much in its ascendancy. There was direct action was very much in the air. So I hit it at a perfect time. And it took me, I was getting involved with direct action literally straight away. So I personally didn't go through that evolution of the letter writing and the stalls and becoming frustrated. But I know lots of people, that's perhaps the most common way that people get into direct action is to go through that frustration.
Mm-hmm.
But we're all different, you know. But to me, sometimes when new people get involved in animal rights, other people have been involved for a long time say, we should be careful how we handle them, you know, because we want them to stay in for a long time, so we should introduce them gently to things. But yet my experience is that people who newly find out about animal abuse are often the most angriest, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And definitely at that point in my life was definitely the most active and the most angry that I've ever been, you know. I was like a tornado at that time.
You've participated in actions that involve liberating animals, and I would think that when you're actually doing this, there must be a feeling that you really are accomplishing something, because it's so practical and you can feel the animals in your arms and you can take them out of these places. So were the actions in which you participated that involved liberating animals highlights for you?
Yes, very much so. But to me, you know, it doesn't matter if it's a laboratory or if it's a dog off the street. You know, it's all liberation. But actually, you know, now you say that, you know, there must have been a feeling of elation. I mean, direct action works, you know, that's its beauty, it's its simplicity. It works by its nature. It's, you know, it's just effective by the because it saves lives, you know. But I must say that thinking about it, some of the most depressing times of my life have been shortly after, like a raid on a laboratory. And once you've got the animals and you've taken them to places where they're going to be safe, for some reason, I remember some of the most crushing, depressing times of my life have been after that. Maybe it's to do with the fact that, you know, you've left some behind, or you get to thinking about maybe the millions and billions of animals that are suffering and you wish you could help them all. So it's not just elation. Really, there is some elation and some feeling of passion in it, but it's also, for me, there was also this backlash afterwards of like really crushing low depression. It only used to last a day or two, you know, but that used to hit me hard.
It's interesting you say that, and especially that you mentioned taking dogs off the street, because Mark and I hear there's big colonies of homeless cats, so most of the people in the neighborhood do absolutely nothing about it. They go on with their daily lives, seeing cats that are hungry, that are sick, that are freezing outside because the temperature is very, very cold here in the winter. It can go down to 30 below zero, 40 below zero, even with the wind. And people do nothing about it. And a few years ago, we just started to feed the cats, and we take them in, and they're sick, we take them in, we take them to the vet, and things like that. So on one hand, it makes us feel good to do that. It makes us feel like we're accomplishing something. But on the other hand, we're experiencing that same exact feeling of depression. I feel since we're doing this, we can never be happy, because every night when we go to bed, we know, like, even yesterday we go to bed, there's a feral cat outside who comes around, we feed him, and we're not able to catch him yet, but we know that he's out there, and we know that he's freezing, and we can never kind of be at peace after that, after we've seen it so directly like that.
Yeah. And do you know, like, you talk about strays and things. You know, to me, one of the things that it really pisses me off, but this, and I think it's crept in the past few years, this idea that there is an animal liberation front.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's not, you know, there never has been. It's just a title for the media, and this support the Animal Liberation Front, and this hero worship of people in balaclavas. To me, it's nonsense, you know, because it's just ordinary people doing extraordinary things. But, and I don't like hero worship of any kind, but if I was going to have heroes in life, to me, my heroes in life are the people that quietly just get on with just doing little bits of good here and there, you know, just a little old lady who does rescue a few cats or... They're my heroes, and there's so many of those people tucked away, but you never get to hear about them, they never make the headlines.
Mm-hmm.
So when I meet them, I'm really, really just humbled by them, you know, I love them.
There's a woman here in the neighborhood, I always talk about her, her name is Mrs. Brown. She's an old, really, really old lady, extremely poor, who's wearing a bad wig, has her teeth shaking in her mouth. Every day at 4 p.m., she is outside feeding the feral cat. She lives in our neighborhood here, so we work with her for the cat. She's the one who's kind of inspired us to start doing this. She uses she probably received some kind of old welfare pension, something like this, and she uses all her money to buy no-name cheap cat food, and she's out there, and the cats know her, and you can tell how the relationship she has with all these feral cats that don't get close to people, even to close to us, and we've been around for a while trying to feed them. They do. As soon as she comes up, they're close to her, and she's able to touch them, and and nobody knows she exists, and nobody even noticed that she's out there every day doing that work, and as you say, she's one person who's a big inspiration, and because that's the kind of people who are doing stuff, and they're not looking for recognition, they're just doing it simply for the sake of the animals.
No, I'm like, when I've done a raid, you know, you don't look for recognition, but you know you can get publicity out of it and lots of things, and that's good, you know, but there can be, like I said, there can be a damaging counter side to that, of the whole hero thing, which can be very damaging, because it's very, to me, it's very disempowering for people who are not involved in it, and they begin to think of this like Superman, Superwoman type thing, you know, that these, and to me that's awful, you know, because the Animal Liberation Front activists are just normal people, you know what I mean? This whole thing that the Animal Liberation Front will come and solve the problems, it's bullshit.
Do you think there's a difference in terms of, like, what people were doing in the 80s in terms of direct action and now? Has it evolved? Like, what is changing? Like, because I remember me when I was 16 years old, I was in the 80s, and I heard about the direct action, people throwing paints at trucks and people liberating animals. And there seemed to be certain activities people were involved in, a certain style, a certain discourse around it. And I'm not sure it's the same anymore. I'm not sure if it's a question of continents, but do you think things have evolved?
Yeah.
So how are things changing?
Well, things definitely change. I mean, we are a movement. We're the Animal Liberation Movement, and a movement by its nature moves, you know, so, and change is the only thing that you can guarantee that happens continually in the universe, you know, so we must change, and we have changed, but we keep to our basic ethics, obviously. I think perhaps the biggest change that there is perhaps back then, and there's always a danger of creating a golden age, you know, because you can make up more bullshit in your head than, oh, in the good old days, you know, romanticising things. But, my God, you know, we were able to do so much without so much police attention. I think that's one big difference, that the system hadn't quite woken up to the fact of what a threat we were. And so we were, like, for example, me, I was able to operate, you know, without any real police harassment and police surveillance and draconian sentences. So that's had its effect. I mean, like I said, when I got involved in 83, there was so much direct action happening of Animal Liberation Front type illegal direct action, and everyone seemed to be at it. Now there's much more, people have to be much more secretive now, much more paranoia. It still goes on, so that's one definite difference.
Mm-hmm. You've noticed, I mean, you've mentioned that, one thing that can be positive about liberating animals, breaking into lessons, that this is the media coverage and bringing attention to animal issues because, you know, sensational, people go, wow, what's happening. Do you find that there's been a change or an evolution in the perception that the public and the media have of direct action?
Oh, my God, totally. I mean, we used to be the Robin Hoods, you know, we used to be the darlings, right? The headlines on the news used to be animals saved from vivisection. You know, quite clearly, remember those news, national news headlines. Now it will be thugs vandalize medical research laboratory, you know. But we've got to go through this stage as well. It's no coincidence. Say in the past 4 or 5 years, I've never witnessed such a non-stop stream of negative propaganda against us. And that has an effect out there on the street. You know, people do, even if they think they don't believe everything they read in the papers and on the telly, of course it seeps through to people's consciousness. And people are perceiving us as, perhaps more so like these days, there is a perception of us as some dangerous antisocial element. You know, which we've got to counter, you know, because we're not anti-social as such. You know, I'm very proud to belong to this movement, and I think we should proudly defend direct action, not as a threat to people, but as a positive benefit to society.
You mentioned earlier also that at some point some of your activism at a certain period in your life was fueled by anger. How do you reflect back on that now? What fuels your activism now? Is it still anger? And thinking back about when it was anger that fueled it.
Are you talking about a bite back interview there?
Yes.
Yeah.
in this interview right now with me, you mentioned anger earlier. So.
Yeah, because I was misquoted in that bite back interview.
Well, explain that to us.
What I did say is, and they put it in big bold headlines, is anger and hatred. Well, I said hatred may make you a bloody good activist, you know, for a while. You know, it will give you so much energy. But for me, and it's only my personal opinion, that with hatred, anyway, there's always a danger. It becomes poison for you.
Mm-hmm.
And it may give you a lot of fire and lots of energy, but it will not sustain you, I don't think, for the rest of your life. Some people might argue against that. I say, no, I've got hatred in my heart, and it's what hatred is what keeps me going. But for me, and I know it sounds all hippie and lovey-dovey, to me it's love and compassion that's going to keep me going.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember a Buddhist man telling me once in India, this Buddhist teacher, very lovely, lovely man he was, very, very nice man. I was telling him all about the animal liberation movement in Europe, and he was very interested, and he was like, oh, very good, very good. And he said, anger, very good, very good. You turn it into action. Yes, very good, very good. Because hatred, very bad, very bad. Poison, it destroys you. And to me, that makes sense. But in the movement, at the moment, there are definite people who just got pure. I'm not ashamed to say it. I don't have hatred for animal abusers. I despise what they do, but I don't hate them. And I sort of ditched hate out of my life. But that doesn't say that I'm not angry. I'm not going to do direct action. Absolutely not. But what's going to generate me in future is I'll make sure it's going to be that love and compassion, and not get blinded with just hatred. You know, I just think it can become a very, very negative thing. And I've seen people come and go, you know, and they're ranting and raving, and 6 months later they're gone.
Mm-hmm.
And they're the most, you know, they're the most keenest people, and bang, they're gone. You know, and if you're going to get involved in this movement, don't just pick it up and play with it. You know, weave it into part of your life, you know, and stay with it for the rest of your life. And to me, I think hatred can blind people. And I know that sounds hippie and people might get turned off by it, but it's my belief, you know. Hatred can blind you to the truth, you know. And to me, like, say you hate these animal abusers. I mean, what does that mean? You know, they're just part of our society.
Mm-hmm.
Our society, the morality or the lack of morality of our society is what spawned these people. To me, this whole good versus evil thing is nonsense. It's like a pantomime, you know, George Bush versus Bin Laden, animal rights versus vivisectors. To me, it's bullshit, and it's not satisfactory enough for me anymore. It doesn't answer the questions. So get angry, but be careful about that, you know, be careful about where that takes you.
Mm-hmm. You know, here in Canada, in the United States, and even in South America, we hear about activists. You know, there are these activists like Barry Horn who died, and Jill Phipps, and they're kind of like figures for people, like hero figures. And they do provide a lot of inspiration for people. And I'm wondering sometimes if it's not because of the distance, and I'm wondering because you've known people personally who have died doing that kind of work. Isn't there a moment where that's very depressing, that it's not just very inspiring and very, you know, when you know somebody who's gotten killed, like not only you must feel angry and upset, but it must be very discouraging and demoralizing sometimes. Whereas that, because here we have such a distance with it, it's only like kind of heroes and fuel and inspiration to continue working and things like that. Because you're so close to it, do you have the same kind of reaction, or do you react the same way people do here?
No, I think there's a similar reaction to it, really. I mean, I know exactly what you mean, but when someone does die fighting, you know, on the front line, I mean, I've known other people that have committed suicide and have died through other reasons that have been very active, but when someone dies on the front line, there is something very, you know, it evokes a warrior feeling, and it just makes you determined never to forget it. So not just because they're my friends, they're still, like I said at the start, I'm not into hero worship, they weren't my heroes, but they've got a big place in my heart, all the people I know, that, you know, my three friends, Mike, Jill and Barry. For me personally, I've always got a special place. I mean, and Barry's a classic one, because me and Barry used to fight like cat and dog, you know, all the time, but I still love him to bits, you know, and what he did, the strength that he showed in his fight, you know, I'll never forget it. And at times, maybe when I'd want to give up and leave the movement or something, you know, the thought of them dying for what they were fighting for. Like, I've nearly died a few times, you know, it could have happened to any one of us. Mm-hmm. So even though it's not, I know what you mean about the hero worship and that, but it's useful to have inspiration, but there's a difference between inspiration and hero worship. So no, they'll always inspire me, even though, you know, they were just, for me, just friends, you know. Can I mention one more thing about that buy back interview?
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I said they misquoted me, because in the buy back interview, in big fat letters, was the bit about hatred and anger will make someone a bloody good activist. And then, but what they didn't say, the bit that was missed out was all the bit that I then talked about, was about the burnout that can follow that. And also they misquoted me on another bit where they asked me, are there any actions that you've thought of as clever, intelligent, or has attracted your attention? And I said that about people sending letters to neighbours of animal abusers saying that they were paedophiles. They put that bit in, but what they didn't put in is that I found that to be okay, it's clever, and it may cause some harassment for the vivisectors for a short while, but it can be disastrous, stuff like that. I actually said the opposite of what they put in. They said, because once the neighbours find out that they're not paedophiles, they'll go, phew, thank God, you know, they're only animal abusers, they only do it to guinea pigs, you know, so my children are safe. So I was quite pissed off with that backbite interview.
Well, that's rectified now, and if we when we put that thing on the radio, it won't be edited, and if we transcribe it and put it around, it'll be textual, so you can be safe that way.
Okay.
Everything will be rectified now.
Yeah, because
you mentioned it in the introduction. Was it done? It was an interview that was done, and there was the person was taking notes, or
I think he recorded it on the phone.
Oh, but
so
he didn't put everything down.
He didn't put everything down.
Yeah.
I think to me, it suited the editorial slant of right back at that time.
Yeah.
But I wasn't totally happy with that interview. I was happy with most of it, but the business about putting in big black letters, anger and hatred makes someone a bloody good activist, is a distortion of the point I wanted to make. My point was, it'll make you a bloody good activist for 6 months for sure, you know? But then maybe there can be some burnout after that, you know? But I'm sitting next to Nancy Phipps at the minute, and there's a woman, she won't tell me how old she is, 70 something, I don't know, she'll go mad, she hates to talk about it. But she's fueled by hatred, do you know what I mean? Me and Nancy fight like cats and dogs. There is a woman, she's fueled by hatred, and it keeps her going. So I'm not saying what I say is true, it's just my thoughts, you know?
And I do find that I don't like that feeling within myself, even though it can give some strength and some energy, eventually I find it kind of eats me from the inside, and
it's
excessive for me, and it ends up not being very healthy mentally for me. And if other people don't have that kind of relationship to it, and they can function on it for a very long time and stay mentally very sane, that's great for them, but that's not my case.
Yeah, and
it's supporting me inside.
I must say, some of our campaigns that we've got now, I think, foster some of that hatred as well.
Mm-hmm.
Get these evil monsters, get these bastards, and shove them up for. You know, like I said, I've been involved for a long time, and I remember all the old Animal Liberation Front newsletters. They weren't full of that rhetoric. You know, these get these monsters, you know? It was go out there and do direct action. So there was no need, I don't think, if you look at the literature 20 years ago, to use all this rhetoric and bile, you know, about these evil people, you know? I'm sick of seeing that now, to be honest, you know? It's just not. To me, it's like a pantomime. And it's just too simplistic. It's too George Bush type language, too dogmatic, and it doesn't really explain the how complicated it is that people can be involved in animal abuse in our society. I mean, if someone's got a sadistic nature, which can happen, they'll get drawn to animal abuse. But I could have ended up somewhere, you know, if I'd have been in the wrong place at the wrong time, and I hadn't gone out with my vegetarian girlfriend, God knows where I might be now. You know, I could be working in a chicken farm. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. So how does that inform then your feeling in terms of activism that targets animal abusers?
Oh, yeah, no. They're responsible for causing, you know, enormous amounts of suffering.
You understand the social, cultural reason or process by which they might end up there. Even though you find their behavior is unacceptable, you understand how things have worked out.
I don't have to sit here at night time and look and making dolls and sticking pins into it,
mm-hmm.
in order to encourage me or other people to do direct action. But don't get wrapped up in the pantomime that everything will be solved if we get rid of this individual, say, for example, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it's this individual's fault why these animals suffer, you know? I'm afraid it's always more complicated than that.
Yeah, there's a framework, too, that's the problem.
But do it. Target people, target companies, but keep your focus of why you're targeting them. You know? If you're targeting them because you think once they go away, then we'll all live happily ever after, then I'm afraid you've got another thing coming.
You're listening to CIUT 89.5. And also CIUT.fm over the internet. That was the premier broadcast of Mira Saleh Ross's interview with UK's John Curtin. He's a former ALF member and is currently a public educator. And that was good to hear from them. Thanks, Mark and Mira, for letting us hear that interview. That will be archived on our website at animalvoices.ca. Now we are going to be turning to an interview with Melissa Takacic and Josh Matlow. And Melissa is an Earth Roots wilderness campaigner, and she's also the Wolves Ontario coordinator. And Josh Matlow is the Earth Roots campaign director, and he's also a Toronto school trustee. And we're going to talk with them today about animal dissection in Toronto schools and what they do to help give students choices about whether or not they dissect. And then after that interview, we're going to be speaking with Captain Paul Watson, who is the master and commander of the Farley Mowat. And there's lots of press about him lately because he is very involved with the seal hunt protests that are occurring right now. And he's very near Newfoundland at this point. We're going to get him by satellite phone and get his perspective on what the seal hunt protests have been like this year. He's the founder of the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society, as well as a founding director of the Greenpeace Foundation, and the author of many different books, including Ocean Warrior and most recently Seal Wars, which was put out in 2002. And we also have in studio right now, we switched Rob's, and Rob Brownridge is also in studio from Vancouver. And so it's great to have you here.
Yes, it's good to be here.
And you're also
usually
a friend of Mel, so it's pretty cool.
I am a friend of Melissa's, yes, to Takacic, so that'll be good. Usually I just listen over the interweb
right. In
Vancouver. You have to get up earlier there, three hours earlier,
yeah.
8 a.m. to listen to Animal Voices, but it's well worth it.
You're a dedicated listener.
So dedicated, yes.
So we're going to come back and talk. Also, hopefully, if we have time, we're going to hear Melissa's perspective on the initiatives that have been happening by environmental groups such as Earthroots to help protect the double-crested cormorant. And this is a pretty interesting species. And she said to me on the phone yesterday that they're kind of a controversial species to protect. So we'll find out about that as well. And we are going now to our interview with Melissa Takacic and Josh Matlow. Thanks for being on the program.
Thank you.
Hi.
Oh, great. We have you both on at the same time. So tell us about animal dissection in Toronto and what you both hope to do to address the issue.
Well, we're very excited because right now the Toronto District School Board is considering a motion introduced by Trustee Matlow to formally adopt a student choice policy in the Toronto District Schools. So this is a fantastic opportunity just to let students know what their rights and choices are. And this is really an issue that I've been concerned about for quite some time, being a student that had to go through biology classes in high school and forced to dissect, and as well going through the university curriculum, wanting to study animals. I want to work to protect animals in the wild, so it seems natural that I would like to take a zoology course, but unfortunately I had to take the botany route because there weren't alternatives at that time. So I think it's very important that students know their rights and that there are great alternatives out there for them to use.
And as a Toronto District School Board trustee myself, and also as a vegetarian, I'm very well aware of times in my life where I've certainly been made in some scenarios to feel uncomfortable about my ethical choices. And I know that there are many students in the board, and many I've received dozens and dozens of correspondence from students across the city who've told me that they've been put in positions by their teachers at times to, in some words, suck it up, too bad, you've got to dissect. In some cases, when they do opt to use the computer simulation, they've found that their grades have suffered because of that choice. So I want to ensure that this this motion supports our students and allows students who have ethical or religious concerns about dissecting animals that, they shouldn't be ostracized, they shouldn't be teased, and they should get the validation of the system.
We have Rob Branridge in the studio, and he actually wanted to ask a question, so I'm going to turn it over to him.
Hi, Melissa and Josh.
Hi.
I was just curious, currently in the Toronto school system, what types of animals are dissected in the high schools, and what are the sources of those animals?
What we found from various sources is that teachers order preserved animals from the state, primarily from different laboratories. They're actually grown in a laboratory, and all types of different specimens, as biology teachers call them, are preserved this way, from frogs to fetal pigs. Those are the most common ones, as well as, I believe, earthworms and perch are common as well. And these are preserved in a carcinogenic compound called formaldehyde. So I would suspect that they would be treated as a hazardous waste, and one has to only imagine how many different dead animals are disposed of after every school year calendar is finished. We're talking about enough animals to fill the biology classes in schools across Ontario and even beyond. This is a common component of many biology classes in Canada.
I'm curious to find out more about the student choice policy because what you had said at the beginning of our interview was that students don't have a choice, but they sort of do have a choice, and some have opted for doing the computer simulation, but then sometimes their grades suffer as a result. What is different about this policy?
Well, there's a current ministry guideline in Queen's Park that states that students have the option to either dissect an animal or use a computer simulation. However, it's a one-line allowance. If students don't know about their rights, obviously it doesn't help them. So what a blind motion does is that it brings information about their rights to the students' ears, to their eyes, before they're put in a position to have to make that decision. So they understand that alternatives are available to them, and this also will ensure that those alternatives are available in the class, and that the responsibility will lie with the school and not the student to provide those alternatives. That students can be allowed to leave the room if they want to, that in no way will they be penalized or ostracized for using an alternative exercise, and that their rights will be available to them in both written and verbal communication. So they understand that it's completely valid to make that choice. And, of course, to ensure that if they do make the choice to use a computer simulation, that they're going to be graded fairly and that they're not going to suffer because of that choice. And I know students that have told me that that has happened to them. Mm. Even though Gerard Kennedy has a guideline stating that they have the choice, and he believes that that guideline really is the end-all and be-all of this and that it supports these kids, I'd like him to speak with, I'd say, about 50 emails that I've received in the last 2 weeks alone from students who have told me otherwise.
Mm. And so where are you at now with the process in terms of trying to bring this the student choice policy forward to the school board, et cetera?
Well, we had a wonderful success about a week and a half ago. We had the motion passed through the Program and School Services Committee, And tomorrow night, it's going to go to board. So we've all been working very, very vigorously to lobby the support of my colleagues and convince them that this is, you know, for some people, this is an animal rights issue. For everyone, this should be a student rights issue.
Mm.
So at the end of the day, there is no reason why not to support this motion. And I hope that your listeners will also contact their local trustee and let them know that they want their support.
So just drop an email or a phone call?
That's right. And all the trustees' emails and phone numbers can be found at www.tdsb.on.ca. So if you want to find out your local trustee, just go there and see what your electoral district is, and you can find your trustee. And if you'd like to read more about the motion, you can go to my website at www.joshmatlow.ca.
And that's Matlow, M-A-T-L-O-W. Great. Thanks to both of you for being on the program. I wanted to snag Mel and to ask her a question about the cormorant issue, because this is something that we had talked about. Unfortunately, we only have a few minutes, but I know that this is an important issue to you. And you said something to me that made me very curious yesterday on the phone. You said that the double-crested cormorant is kind of a controversial species to protect. Tell us about this bird.
It is, unfortunately, this species is the victim of an enormous misinformation campaign that rarely gets corrected by wildlife decision makers. And the reason why it is so vilified is because it eats a lot of fish and it destroys the trees that it nests on. And there are people who perceive that there is an overpopulation problem of cormorants because they're a very visible colonial bird. They typically nest in very large colonies. In Presqu'île Provincial Park, we had about 12,000 of these birds in a protected bird sanctuary, but that was too many birds for the local community and many anglers in the area who are frustrated seeing these birds compete with them for the same fish. But that also is a bit of an exaggeration, because cormorants actually play a very important role in the ecosystem. Much of their diet is invasive species, such as alewives and round gobies, which are actually very destructive to the environment. So instead of being celebrated for their ecological service, they've unfortunately been made into a big scapegoat for problems in the Great Lakes ecosystem and diversity in the fisheries.
And so where are we at now in terms of their protection?
Well, today is the official Welcome Back Home Cormorants Day at City Hall. Mayor Miller has officially announced today as a day that we can celebrate these birds, because on the Leslie Street Spit we have a very diverse bird colony, and cormorants make up a big part of that colony. So we are going to have an event right there at 12:30. There'll be a slideshow by the Toronto Ornithological Club just explaining to people what this bird is all about, because they're a very misunderstood species. Unfortunately, the Ministry of Natural Resources is considering whether or not to cull more of these birds in Presqu'île Provincial Park this year, and so letters are strongly needed to voice people's opinion about whether these birds should be protected. So we strongly encourage that. People can find more information on EarthRoots' website at www.earthroots.org.
Will there be any cormorants at the rally today?
They'll be there in spirit, and there'll be beautiful slideshows as well. There is a James Audubon print that is going to be on display from the Toronto Reference Library. This bird actually made it on the new Canada Post stamps going to the United States, which is another kind of rather ironic that we're celebrating this bird on a postage stamp, yet the Ontario government hasn't recognized its important role as a symbol of Canada's natural heritage.
Melissa, thanks for being on the program today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
If there are people who want any information about what Josh and Melissa were speaking about today, you can go to our website, animalvoices.ca, and we'll post information there about EarthRoots and also about what you can do to get involved with trying to get the Toronto School Board to start looking seriously at the student choice policy on animal dissection. We were speaking with Melissa Tkaczyk. She's involved with WISPA, World Society for Protection of Animals, as well as she's the EarthRoots Wilderness Campaigner and the Wolves Ontario Coordinator. And we also heard from Josh Matlow, who is the EarthRoots Campaign Director and a Toronto School Trustee. You're listening to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM. We are going to take a very short break, and then we are going to try our very best to get Captain Paul Watson from the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society on the line.
Sat phone.
And on satellite phone, and talk to him about the seal hunt protests and what they hope to accomplish with the Farley Mullet. Please stay tuned. Animal Voices, CIUT 89.5. Hello and welcome back to Animal Voices, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm your host, Lauren Corman, here with Rob Brownridge in studio. Instead of Rob Moore, he took off to go to work. We are still in the process of trying to get Captain Paul Watson on the line via satellite phone, so this is always a bit of a trick. So in the interim, as we're trying to get someone on the line to speak about the sealed hunt protests that have been happening, I just wanted to ask Rob a quick question since we have you in studio. So tell us about your experiences as a Toronto vegetarian and now going back to your roots, a Vancouver vegetarian.
Yeah, and this is not filler at all.
No.
well, I'm from originally from Vancouver, and I lived off and on in Toronto for about 2 years, and I just had a very interesting perspective. And when I was in Toronto, I found that there was a higher proportion of really intense vegetarians and vegans here in Toronto. You know, they would have potlucks and have meetings and show PETA videos and discuss it, and it just seemed to be really more intense, like a smaller, more tight-knit community that was a bit more hardcore. And back in Vancouver, that's not quite the same. And my little theory is just because in Vancouver there is, it's pretty easy to be a vegetarian. There's lots of vegetarians and vegetarian choices. And also there's so much nature surrounding. I know this sounds very cliche, but there is a lot of nature surrounding. And I just think people are a bit more, it's easier to live there and think that things aren't so bad environmentally, animal rights wise, everything.
That like world, vacation land.
Yeah, the world, the world might turn it around. And I thought maybe there's something to do with the fact that Toronto is such a city, and it's easy to be here and not see the end of the city. You know, it just it's all encompassing.
Rob,
so that's my little perspective.
Yeah, I'm going to cut you guys off.
Good.
Tell us what we
have. We have Tim on the phone, who is from the Sea Shepherd, but it's not the person on the satellite, who I will, if you want me to, keep trying for the next 5 minutes.
Sure, we can try. We'll hopefully get him on next week.
Okay,
so Tim.
Now Tim's on the phone.
From Sea Shepherd Conservation Society. Tell us who you are.
Hi, my name is Tim Migjali. I'm the International Director of Sea Shepherd Conservation Society, and I'm happy to tell you anything I can about what we're doing right now in the ice off the coast of Labrador.
I guess I'd like to talk about sort of general goals as well as just some of the extremely controversial news that's been coming out about the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society. In particular, there was a big story that broke about a sealer's name that was posted on a weblog. So I guess those are sort of the two main issues. What do you hope to accomplish with the Farley Mullet this year, and what have some of the experiences been of the activists, and also what's your response to some of the controversy around this case with the sealer's name being posted on the weblog?
Okay, taking what we're doing first, of course, our whole goal on the ice, in the killing fields, as we call them, where the baby seals are killed, is to let people know that this is still happening. The general impression we get from many people, including particularly people in Canada, is that the seal hunt has stopped, that it's not happening anymore. Mm. Most Canadians and most people around the world seem to think that it stopped back in the 70s when Brigitte Bardot made it a cause célèbre. And since then, it seems to have been just quietly pushed under the under the carpet and swept away so that nobody notices it. So our intention this year was very much to bring it to the forefront, to make it news, to make people sit up and understand that this is still happening and they need to do something to stop it. So putting that in perspective, all of the things we've been doing on the ice have been basically to get this into the public attention, to let people know that it's happening and try to stop it as much as possible.
So
at least so they can bring pressure on their government to stop it.
Right. So what has been happening out on the ice this year? What have been how have the activists been interacting with the sealers, and what are some of the incidences that have happened? I've read things on both sides that death threats have been hurled both by animal activists, not necessarily the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society folks, but animal activists in general, as well as the sealers. What's your perspective on that?
I think our public position about death threats is we don't make them. We're for life. We're not for death. We're not for killing even people. perhaps I should say especially not people, but we're for life. We're not for killing people. We do not approve of anybody making death threats. And that's very clear, and Paul Watson has said it a number of times, most recently in response to the problems with the moblog posting that you referred to. That mobile log posting did include the name and telephone number of the owner of a vessel from which the crew, including particularly the captain, went out and attacked our activists on the ice. They were there trying to talk to the sealers, trying to photograph them, doing their job. And they were set upon. The whole crew of the ceiling of a ship came out and set upon our activists with their hacker picks and other clubs. Following the name and address going up on the website, apparently he received death threats. I don't know if he really did or if this is some way he's just trying to get sympathy. Obviously, we don't know. My understanding is that no police complaint has been made, although there were reports of that earlier. The CMP don't know anything about it. I think it's a storm in a teacup. I think they're just making something up to try to get themselves some sympathy, to be honest.
So the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society is the primary reason that you're out on the ice and in the boat is because you're trying to document, or are you actually trying to disrupt the seal hunt?
Our primary purpose is to let people know it's happening. And to do that, we want to document it so that we can put the pictures out there, so we can get the put the video out there. You can go to our website and download video and pictures. We show what's happening. And that's our primary purpose, to let people know about it. And, of course, we'll do whatever will further that goal. And sometimes that includes getting involved with the sealers to some extent, having some interactions with them. But our primary goal is it's publicity. It's letting people know. And that means documentation, and it means, in some ways, sometimes having some interaction, certainly, with the sealers.
And what's had the interactions so far have been, it sounds fairly tense.
Generally, what's happened is, what happened in the Gulf, of course, the seal slaughter takes place in two parts. Initially, it's in the Gulf of St. Lawrence. And there, when we came across a sealing ship with sealers doing their bloody work, our crew would leave the ship, or some of them would, with cameras to go and photograph, and the sealers would immediately flee back to the sealing ship and leave the seals. Well, that was one way of saving some seals, so we weren't unhappy about it, but we obviously were not getting some of the photographs we would like. In one case, with the Brady Mariner, the one we've already talked about, where the captain's name and telephone number was put on the web, in that case, they didn't flee. They came back and came charging at us. And that's the only really tense encounter we've had, to be honest.
Right, and so how long are you going? We're just wrapping up the interview now, but I wanted to ask you how long you're planning to be out on the ice.
Well, now the second part of the hunt, slaughter, as we prefer to call it, was due to begin today. Because of very bad weather conditions, it's been postponed for 2 days. Usually it takes them about 3 days to kill 300,000 baby seals. Which is incredible just for its sheer ferocity, the numbers they can get through. We would expect to be there until they reach their quota. That's been delayed 2 days, so the hunt, the slaughtering will now start on Thursday the 14th, and we would expect to be there until it finishes maybe the 16th or the 17th.
Thanks so much for filling in for Captain Paul Watson. We really appreciate talking with you today, Tim.
You're very welcome, and I'm sorry I'm very much your second best. He would have
no,
given you
that's
a much
okay.
Better story.
It was lots of good information. We'll direct people on our website. Thank you very much.
Yeah, if people could get one to further information, of course, it is on our website at www.seashepherd.org.
Great, and that's also linked on our website as well. You've been listening to Animal Voices, CIUT 89.5 FM. We heard an interview with John Curtin at the beginning of the hour by Mira Saleh Ross, and then we heard from Melissa Tkachuk and Josh Matlow talking about the animal dissection issue in Toronto schools, and we also talked to Melissa about the double-crested cormorant issue in Toronto. And we just spoke with Tim from the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society, and next week we're trying to get on Captain Paul Watson directly from the ice floes and hear more about some of the direct action that's been happening. Animal Voices, CIUT 89.5. Thanks, Lamia, for teching, and also for Rob Brownridge being here today in studio.